Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting new books, and we interview the authors of those books. And this week I'm very pleased to say we have a visitor to our shores, Clive Hamilton, who's come all the way from Australia to talk to us, and we'll be talking about his very interesting and provocative and very timely book, Earth Masters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering. Clive, could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, my formal designation is Professor of Public Ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra. I'm best thought of not so much as an academic, perhaps, but as a public intellectual. I founded a think tank, a progressive think tank in the early 1990s and ran that for many years. And now I spend my time writing books, giving public talks and so on, mostly on matters related to climate change.
Mm-hmm. And you spend a lot of time on airplanes, I imagine.
I try not to. So I limit that. So this trip to the US, I've tried to pack in as much as I can so I don't need to come back for a while.
Yeah, well, again, thanks for being on the show. So tell us why you wrote Earth Masters, The Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering.
Well, I wrote a previous book called Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth of Climate Change, which was published here in the US, and it really was examining exactly that question. What is it that has allowed governments and indeed populations of countries like the United States to ignore or downplay or dismiss the vast body of scientific evidence saying that we're in deep trouble and we need to act quickly? And the gap between what the scientists are saying must be done and what is actually being done continues to grow. Month by month, year by year, we human beings just passed through 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the highest level it's been for 3 million years. And so, you know, we are transforming the planet in very dangerous ways, and yet we seem unable to respond. And recognizing that institutional and political sclerosis, a number of scientists said, well, we need a plan B. And they said they started to investigate geoengineering schemes, of which there are quite a range. And so I've obviously studied geoengineering in a lot of depth. And, you know, it's a very complex and worrying development. So that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah. I took your – at one point in the book, you say Wikipedia has, I think, 72 different – proposals for bioengineering and engineering the Earth's atmosphere. So I looked them up. Some of them are pretty wacky.
Some of them are.
Yeah. So
the sort of big one that is also wacky, or is still in the realm of sci-fi, is putting a cloud of mirrors space to deflect some sunlight.
So yeah. That'll come right after jetpacks, I think. So this book covers the issue of what to do about global warming in a variety of perspectives. One of them is actually sort of talking about some of the proposals and then talking about how they might be implemented in terms of public policy and our inability to implement them and perhaps how we might do it. So could you start by saying, so what actually can be done realistically about this in terms of engineering climate?
Well, geoengineering is, in its broadest definition, intentional technological intervention in the climate system designed to counter global warming or to offset some of its effects. And as you say, Marshall, there are a range of schemes, but there are probably only sort of six or eight that are sort of taken seriously and are being systematically investigated.
Yeah, can you run us through those just really briefly? Is that possible? Is that too many?
Yeah, let me try.
Okay.
Okay, so there are sort of fairly straightforward methods that we know about to do with the landscape, and particularly the creation of biochar, kind of charcoal, which fixes carbon from vegetation and stores it, you know, one hopes, for a very long time. There are a whole lot of methods, or a number of methods, designed to somehow extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And there are a range of schemes here. One is to just do it directly using an array of big metal boxes that suck it out of the atmosphere and fix it, perhaps in the form of calcium carbonate, and then find somewhere safe underground to store it, you know, in perpetuity, one hopes. And another scheme, which is called a carbon dioxide removal method as well, is so-called ocean iron fertilization. This idea of spreading iron sulfate on patches of ocean, because iron is a nutrient needed for marine life. And if this nutrient is missing in a patch of ocean, then you can get very rapid blooms of algae by spreading iron sulfate. And algae, as life forms, grow by absorbing, among other things, carbon dioxide from the surface waters of the ocean. And when they die, the idea is that they will take their carbon to the bottom of the ocean where it'll be stored. So you get it out of the atmosphere and put it in the bottom of the ocean. But probably the headline scheme for geoengineering is not one aimed at getting carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, but at directly countering the warming of the globe. And this is one of a suite of methods known as solar radiation management, and it's called sulfate aerosol spraying. The idea is to mimic the effect of large volcanic eruptions. It's been known for quite a long time that large volcanic eruptions put so much dust and sulfate particles into the atmosphere that they dim the globe for a year or two. And this dimming means not as much sunlight reaches the Earth, and therefore the Earth cools. So the Earth has been shown to cool for perhaps by half a degree but for a year or two as a result of a large volcanic eruption, such as that at Mount Pinatubo in 1991. So the idea is to, instead of leaving it to nature, we would intervene by sending up a fleet of aircraft specially fitted to spray sulfate aerosols into the upper atmosphere, into the stratosphere, and effectively surround the Earth with a layer of tiny particles that would reduce the amount of solar radiation reaching the Earth and thereby cool it.
Mm-hmm. So before we talk about whether any of these are practicable and how we might get there, I'm remembering there's a scene in Jurassic Park where the Jeff Goldblum character, after learning what they have done in terms of engineering or bringing back to life by genetic engineering dinosaurs, he says, "You just really don't mess with Mother Nature because you just don't know what the consequences will be. The system is too complicated." That's one view. And then there's another view that says that the climate, that the biosphere is extraordinarily robust. That is, we are not really in a position to tinker with it very much. That is, we can't really change it. And that would suggest that maybe some of these schemes would be practicable. What is the sort of general thinking about this? For example, if you put big boxes everywhere that absorb carbon, or you seeded the ocean so that plankton did it, how would you control those things?
Well, there are two dimensions to this. One is that some geoengineering methods are relatively benign, whereas others are far more risky. I mean, trying to regulate the temperature of planet Earth with a solar shield would have all sorts of ramifications and impacts of which we can only have the vaguest idea. So that's one dimension. The schemes themselves are variable in their risks and also in their possible effectiveness. But there's another dimension too, and you can see amongst geoengineering scientists or climate scientists in general, a different, although they all agree, of course, on climate change and its causes and the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Nevertheless, their understanding of the Earth is informed by some really quite radically different I don't know what you call them, sort of orientation toward world and life. And so some climate scientists are very gung-ho and say, look, you know, we've engineered every other environment we live in. Why can't we engineer planet Earth? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are things we don't know yet, but, you know, our research will solve those problems, and we can go in there and you know, after all, when you engineer a system, you do it and you see what the problems are, you tinker with it, you fix it. So what's the problem? But then down at the other end, and of course there are a bunch somewhere in between, you've got scientists who say, look, the Earth is astonishingly complex. we don't know how it's going to react. The paleoclimate record shows that, as Wally Brocker said, the Earth is an ornery beast that overreacts in small nudges. So you've got these two very different conceptions of what the Earth is and mm-hmm. how it operates. And obviously, if you're at the Wally Brocker end, that the Earth is very unstable, unpredictable, you know, has its own kind of unstable psychology, if I can put it that way, then tinkering with the Earth system as a whole is an extremely hazardous thing to think about. But then you've got this whole kind of Western technological notion that we can and have a right to dominate nature, and we have or could have the technological means, so we should just go for it.
One question I had about these schemes is that, you know, if you think about it scientifically, one of the things we like to do before we roll out a technology is test it. And we usually do it in a lab. How do you test any of these to see what their effect might be? I suppose they have massive computer models and things, but how do you test whether, you know, the box approach or the seeding the ocean approach or whatever approach it might be would yield the results that you want it to in a convincing way? So people would say, yeah, you know, that's going to work.
Well, it depends on the technology. Sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere through metal boxes and burying it underground is something you can do on a small scale and see if it works. Mm-hmm. There is a problem with that. If you're burying it underground, it has to stay there for thousands of years, isn't it? If the carbon dioxide in one form or another leaks out, then it's all pointless. But others, ocean iron fertilization, for example, cultivating algal blooms to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and put it to the bottom of the ocean, is more tricky because the oceans are enormously complex. Yeah, so how it would affect marine life in general is really something that's not well understood. So, for example, you might get a tremendous algal bloom behind the ship where you're spreading the sulfate particles, iron sulfate. But there's a real danger of what's known as nutrient stealing, that the algae that blooms in that area steal nutrients from adjacent patches of ocean, and that so marine life actually declines there. So to get a good sense of that would require a huge amount of research. Mm-hmm. When it comes to, you know, the headline scheme, sulfate aerosol spraying, surrounding the Earth with a layer of sulfate particles, we would really have no idea of how that would work without actually doing it. You can't, you know, do that over, you know, a part of Nebraska and say, well,
it's cool. How about a part of New York first? I'm from that area of the country. Let's try New York before Nebraska.
Let's try New York. And you couldn't do it over New York and say, hey, this works, and now we'll do it over the world, because you're talking about changing the total climate system of the planet. And so in that case, we wouldn't know until we'd done it. Not only would we not know until we'd done it, we wouldn't know until we'd done it, it's estimated, for at least 10 years. Because if you've got sulfate aerosol spraying changing the planet's climate, then that adds to, of course, natural variability, which we know the climate system is very complicated, and also the effects of global warming itself from carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. So we'd need at least 10 years of implementing, putting in place this global solar shield before we had enough data to separate out the effects of the solar shield from the effects of natural variability and the effects of human-induced climate change as well. Mm-hmm. So we might become stuck with it.
Right. Well, this is precisely my concern. I mean, for example, if you're going to put an aerosol into the Earth's atmosphere, and let's say it does work, well, aren't you committed to that for all time then if you don't draw back the amount of carbon emissions? Or is that part of the plan? Like, this is just going to be a kind of temporary Band-Aid, and we're actually going to reduce carbon emissions so that when it goes away, we'll be all right.
Well, that's what most scientists working on it say, that their objective is to essentially buy some time to suppress global warming and therefore offset some of the worst effects of climatic change while the world gets its act together. Mm-hmm. And while it gets its act together technologically or politically.
Yeah, that seems to me to be a huge bet, though, a huge and risky bet, because the world has never really gotten its act in order, at least. Well, I mean, I suppose optimists might say that it has in various ways, but it's hard to argue that on a scale like this that the world has come together.
Well, the risk, and look, on the one hand, there are some positive things happening in the climate area. China's massive investment in renewable energy technology. Certain nations are promoting wind power, solar power, and so on and so forth. So there are some signs of hope, but the factors that work against that are so overwhelming. I mean, of course, we went through 400 parts per million. We continue to grow. Even if China in, say, 50, 20 years reaches a peak of emissions and then declines, then we've just got India coming up behind, going to sort of repeat China. So it's a pretty bleak prospect. So the problem with buying time is that the buying time argument is that we may become habituated to solar radiation management, and you're going to have some powerful forces who will prefer solar radiation management as a substitute for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So the danger is that if we, we've got this solar shield up there, we've suppressed the temperature by a degree or two, things aren't sort of going in such a bad direction as we thought. So we continue to burn fossil fuels and fill the atmosphere with carbon dioxide. So that if we run into problems with our solar shield, let's say, we discover it destroys the ozone layer, which is a potentiality, or there's some global conflict because, it fixes the United States' climate, but it ruins, India, Pakistan, and we decide, there's pressure to take down the solar shield, then there's this massive amount of global warming that we've just suppressed. It hasn't gone away. We've just suppressed it.
Right.
Carbon dioxide is still there. And so if we take down the solar shield, it all comes rushing back enormously quickly. Then we're really in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me that a good historical example would be nuclear power. We knew that nuclear power was somewhat dangerous due to what it leaves in its trail. But there are places now that can't do without it. I mean, France can't give up nuclear power tomorrow. France can't give up nuclear power at all.
No, it relies on nuclear power for some 80% of its electricity.
Yeah.
So, supply.
Yeah, so it seems to be a tremendous problem with any of these schemes. And then the other problem, let's talk a little bit about policy and how to make it and how to implement it. You would need a scale of cooperation on the international level that we have never seen. Is that true? At least it seems to me.
Well, in an ideal world, to do geoengineering relatively safely and relatively democratically, we would need global cooperation. And in a way, there's a strong incentive for all countries, if there were some global process, to participate in it and not try to undermine and destroy it, as is the case with the Kyoto Protocol, for example. But geoengineering is different. Whereas to tackle global greenhouse gas emissions, you have to get some agreement to act on the part of all of the major polluting nations. In the case of geoengineering, one major nation or even one mid-sized nation could do it. They could be up and doing it in the next few years.
Right.
This is the problem with some forms of geoengineering. They're just cheap. Sulfate aerosol spraying is thought to be much cheaper than reducing global greenhouse gas emissions. And so there's a significant concern of unilateral action on the part of one nation, which obviously has enormous geostrategic implications. One nation is controlling the world's climate. And what do other nations think about that?
Is there any way, for example, with the shield idea, to control the dispersion of this stuff in such a way that it wouldn't cause a series of international incidents as it drifted over your borders? Or,
well, it's not so much the pollution itself, because the whole idea when you put it there in the upper atmosphere, the atmosphere is divided into the troposphere, the lower part, which is where all the weather happens, because in the troposphere, the first 10 or 12 kilometres of air, the weather goes horizontally and vertically, or air moves horizontally and vertically, whereas when you get into the stratosphere above that, the air only moves horizontally. And so you stick the sulfate particles up there, and the whole point is to disperse it quickly around the globe as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it's not so much the fact that the sunlight has been dimmed over various countries, although that is a potential problem for photosynthesis. It's more that the whole climate system of the world as a whole is changed.
Mm-hmm.
One hopes change for the better, but not necessarily for everyone, because although it would have a fairly uniform effect around the world in terms of reducing global temperatures, the impact on global precipitation, on rainfall patterns, would be more variable. And so with sulfate aerosol spraying, you may get an increase in precipitation in some areas, but a decline in others. And so this obviously opens up the risk for global disputes over geoengineering schemes.
Right. Well, I mean, it seems to me to be a great risk to what we call pedestrianly, if that's a word, sovereignty, because you're having another nation basically change the weather over your nation, and that's not usually considered to be kosher.
It's definitely not kosher. I mean, we know that there's a long interest within the military in controlling the weather for hostile purposes. So you can see the kind of potential.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if Napoleon or Hitler could have up Russia, the world history could have been quite different.
Mm-hmm.
And so, this is why, in my view, the absence of global governance of geoengineering research, leading potentially to deployment, you know, 2-3 decades down the track, is really a serious concern, and why the efforts of people who are engaged in this, who are worried about the kinds of risks I've talked about, should focus on promoting forms of global governance that mm-hmm. Give an opportunity for all nations, and particularly those that are vulnerable, poor countries that are vulnerable to the effects of climate change and geoengineering, should be engaged in the process of regulating and governing geoengineering.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, are there any efforts to move in that direction? I mean, I suppose there are. Can you talk about them? Global governance is obviously something that scares the pants off a lot of Americans. I can say that with great assurance. But schemes in which much of the world cooperates in order to get this thing done. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there are some early moves towards this. For example, the London Convention, which regulates dumping in the ocean, and the US is a signatory of that. I mean, the US has an interest in stopping other countries dumping waste from their ships in near the US.
Mm-hmm.
There are moves at the London Convention by a number of countries to regulate geoengineering experiments, which would involve a kind of ocean dumping iron sulfates into the ocean, for example, or lime as another geoengineering scheme to counter the effects of acidification. Also at the Convention on Biological Diversity, there have been a couple of resolutions which have been aimed at not so much banning, but imposing sort of license conditions on those who want to carry out experiments in ocean fertilization or other forms of geoengineering that affect the oceans. Now, the United States is not a signatory to the Convention on Biological Diversity, but you can see that it certainly has an interest in making sure that, China, for example, doesn't start large-scale experimentation on to regulate the chemical composition of the ocean. So I would have thought that the United States, despite this kind of paranoid fear of the UN in some quarter, would see that it has a strong interest in participating in some kind of global governance mechanism.
Yeah, yeah. The American attitude toward the UN and global governance is sort of contradictory, because on the one hand, many American politicians, and I even think most Americans, will say that the UN is completely powerless and worthless. And then on the other hand, they will be very afraid of it. I don't really understand how those two ideas fit together. But one of the things you mentioned does seem to me like it is practicable, and that is some sort of international agreement on experimentation, because we already have that with nuclear weapons. That one worked.
Yeah, we do. We do have international agreements to regulate certain kinds of activities, of which the US is, a vigorous participant.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that the powers that be in the US will override that, the kind of populist paranoia about the UN that is present in some quarters, because it'll be seen to be in the United States' interest to have a role to play. I mean, if other countries are engaged in some cooperative effort on geoengineering research and possible deployment, then the U.S. and certainly the U.S. military would want to have an interest in that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And are there ongoing experiments now on a small scale that we could look to? And another question is, who funds this sort of research?
Well, there are a few experiments in various fields going on. I mean, in biochar experimentation going on. There have been attempts to carry out experiments in sulfate aerosol spraying, which have come to grief so far, but although a couple have happened in Russia. And, of course, there have been a series of experiments, some respectable and well-regulated and some by cowboys, carried out on ocean iron fertilization. But what we're seeing is we're seeing venture capitalists and people with their eye on a pot of money being drawn to geoengineering as a sort of new frontier mm-hmm. for investment. But there are also some people who are much more serious, who are concerned about global climate change and see geoengineering as something that is going to attract a lot of attention and interest. And so, for example, Bill Gates is investing quite a bit in geoengineering research and in a couple of companies that are researching geoengineering and taking out patents. In fact, Bill Gates' name is on a couple of patents issued by the U.S. Patent Office over geoengineering technologies.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're about out of time, but I want to ask one final question, and that is this. It's actually not the final question. There'll be one more, but I suppose somebody could argue that even speaking about geoengineering projects in a kind of hopeful way creates a kind of hazard, and that is that even before they exist, if they can exist, you're already encouraging people not to cut back their carbon emissions. People will be saying, well, you know, these engineers are really smart, and they're going to figure it out, much in the same way I think the French probably thought, well, you know, this nuclear waste, it's really bad, but heck, we're really smart. We're going to figure it out. We'll get rid of it. We'll jettison it into space or something, which never happened. Are you worried about this at all?
I think this is one of the major anxieties, that once we head down this path, it will gather around it a powerful constituency. We can all already see some conservative political forces in the U.S. starting to say that, hey, geoengineering can get us out of this mess. You know, we don't have to accept what these environmentalists are saying about the need to shift to renewable energy. We can use American ingenuity to tackle this technologically. So it's kind of the techno fix to end all techno fixes. And as you know, a techno fix is a technological solution to a social problem. And so the political and economic allure of geoengineering, I think, is going to be very powerful. And the more powerful it becomes, the less attention will be directed towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
I think that's true. I mean, I guess I would say, given my cursory reading of the press, I don't read it terribly closely, is that geoengineering projects are not exactly front page news here yet. People don't talk about them a lot. They talk about the Kyoto protocols and these other things. They talk about greenhouse gas emissions and clean coal and fracking and other things, but they're not really talking about engineering the Earth's atmosphere. But I can easily see how there would be interest in this and how it could kind of lull people into a sense of security that you know, we're going to fix this eventually. So Jesus, we shouldn't worry. Let's go buy another SUV kind of thing. And I guess I'm a little worried about that.
Well, and that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, in pretty much every country, the surveys that have been done suggest that perhaps less than 5% of the population knows what geoengineering is.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone will know what it is in 10 years' time. I'm certain of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wrote this book because I wanted to help frame public understanding and thinking about geoengineering, because at the moment it's been determined very much by a small group of North American scientists who are promoting geoengineering research very strongly. And I think there are a lot of risks and dangers. And so I'm keen for a wide variety of people in civil society to learn about geoengineering and get engaged, because it's not going to go away.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. People have to pay attention to it in a serious-minded way and not be terribly frightened by it or terribly positive about it. Because, you know, I mean, I think any engineer will tell you that if you operate within design constraints and you make a choice, it's always a trade-off. You're not there's no just win-win situation in engineering.
Yeah.
You're going to suffer something. So anyway, we've taken up a lot of your time. Clive, let me ask you our traditional final question. What are you working on now?
Well, really, I can't let go of this question because you know, at the end of the book, I talk a bit more philosophically. I ask, well, what does it mean for human beings at the beginning of the 21st century to start seriously talking about taking control of the climate system of the Earth as a whole and regulating it in perpetuity? To me, it represents a sort of radical transition in what we are as beings and our relationship to planet Earth. So it's really exploring those kinds of questions further that is going to occupy me for the next little while.
Yeah, I mean, actually, some historians, what are called big history historians, have talked about this for some time. And I think they, you know, we're in the Holocene now, and they talk about the Homocene. That is the moment at which, the moment at which humans are really taking control of the geology of the Earth. Actually, some of these people are from Australia. David Christian, for example, is a pioneer in this sort of stuff. So I'm sure you know about that literature. But anyway, I want to say to everybody who tuned in, thank you very much. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and today we've been talking with Clive Hamilton about his book, Earthmasters, the Dawn of the Age of Climate Engineering. So thank you for listening, but I especially want to thank Clive for being on the show today from New York. Thank you very much, Clive.
Thanks, Marshall. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.